You mentioned the name David, and usually there are two episodes in David's life that are always repeated over and over. I said, David and, you would say, Goliath, and then David and Bathsheba. Kind of the high and the low of David's life. And it's really interesting because with David and Bathsheba, it was a terrible incident. Don't get me wrong, but there's going to be, I guess if you're going to talk about body count, and the number of people that die because of a certain incident. This incident gets a bunch of people killed. There's a later incident that David does that gets even a whole lot more people killed. But this one is actually highlighted by God as something that is very displeasing to him, and it's pretty obvious what it is that he does. So we're going to talk about it. I'll probably get into trouble today, and that's okay too. The kids are all talking about this, so you got a lot to talk about with your children after this. No, I'm just kidding. She's being very sensitive about how all of this stuff is presented. King George and the Ducky is the platform so that it's more of a contentment with what you got issue as opposed to a sexual lust issue that we're going to be talking about in here. I don't know when it was that I heard a sermon on 2 Samuel chapter 11, which chronicles how affairs take place. I've had the burden of helping, I think, five or six couples go through an affair, and I'm right around 50-50. Half of them make it, half of them don't. Every time I talk to couples or people that have had affairs, it follows a very predictable pattern. And it follows the pattern of David, and it follows this pattern of this sermon. I don't even know who preached the sermon, but I remember the three stages of an affair and how it takes place. It starts off with a distraction, goes into an attraction, which then ultimately leads to the action. And that you can track every single time. And every time I've talked to people that have done affairs, this is how it happens. So if you are able to see that pattern going, hopefully you should be able to stop it before it gets to the next stage. We'll talk about that a little bit more after we read this story. So let's take a look at it. 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Right off the bat, there's a problem because, as we know, when there is a war, where is David usually at when a war is taking place? He's on the front lines. He's down with the troops. He wants to be a part of. That's been his history. He's never broken from that pattern. All of a sudden, he breaks from that pattern. Now, I don't know how much to read into that, but I do know that sometimes when things are idle for poor King David, that's when trouble starts taking place. Write it in your notes, because later I think it's kind of humorous, something that takes place. Rabbah is 50 miles away. So the fighting is relatively far away. I mean, if we had a car, it would be a little bit easier to get there. They didn't have that back then. 50-mile trip down there. So, one evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. It was a typical thing of back in those days. The roofs were the patios, in that you'd have flat roofs, you would put chairs, lounges, stuff like that, a little smoking bar. That's where you kind of hung out. So he's up there on the roof, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. That it's not sunbathing, okay? First of all, it's nighttime. And second of all, the word bathing does actually mean washing. So she's actually up there taking a very literal bath. The woman was very beautiful. The phrase "very beautiful" probably is better translated, she was very pleasant to look at. Now, because I started to think about this, well, I don't really know what Bathsheba looks like. It says she's very beautiful, she's pleasant to look at. I don't know what kind of distance David is looking at. You kind of get the feeling that he was just out there. It's nighttime, he's getting up from his bed. It could be daytime. I should say this, but the inference is he's up from his bed. So I kind of get the sense that it's nighttime. May not be. You got someone from a distance and bathing. I think at this point, he's really only looking at a physical outline. Because he asked the question, David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "You're married, you fool. You shouldn't be." Oh, wait, sorry. I missed that one. I tell you, so many lines get crossed in this thing that so many opportunities were given for David to stop what he's doing. First and foremost, the first thing he could have done was just go back to bed. But no, he doesn't just look once. He doesn't just look twice. He looks and he looks and he looks to the point that he actually has this desire in him. And then when he asked his a man with him, when he asked one of his attendants, the guy doesn't even have the guts to say, "That's a bad idea, David. If you ever get to the point where you don't have someone honest in your life to tell you the truth, then you're in a whole lot of trouble. You should always have someone that can come to you and simply tell you the truth. What you're doing is wrong, and you are stepping into something that you should not step into." But he doesn't. The man says, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" At that point, David could have stopped. Because the question has to get asked, did David know Bathsheba prior to this incident? I would say, absolutely he knew who Bathsheba was. How am I aware of this? Well, A, it's just Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam. And who is Eliam? Eliam is listed in 2 Samuel 23 among the 30. This was David's private army bodyguard group of people. They were called David's mighty men. And out of the David's mighty men, he had three who were like the mightiest men of all. And then there was 27 others. And in 2 Samuel, it lists it. And look who's there. Eliam, son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Which then got me to thinking, does David know Ahithophel? Essentially, Bathsheba's grandfather. Well, let's find out. In 1 Chronicles 27, Ahithophel was the king's counselor. Do you think that somewhere along the way, David knew Bathsheba? That's right. A lot of people say, well, I mean, at first he's like, well, who is that? I think the reason why he says who is that is because she's far away on another roof. And he's up in the palace looking down, so he can't make out who it is that he's looking at. But once it's told who it is, David already knows who it is. Later on, Ahithophel, in 2 Samuel 16, this is a very sad, David eventually gets driven from the palace, and Ahithophel decides to side with one of David's kids, Absalom, who was essentially making a play for the throne. And so Absalom's thinking, what can I do to take over the power a little bit more? And check out what Ahithophel answers. Lie with your father's concubines, who he left to take care of the palace. Then all Israel will hear that you've made yourself stench in your father's nostrils, and the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened. And guess what? Absalom does. He does it. So do these people all know each other? Yeah, this isn't some strange action. And you gotta admit, isn't that how affairs really happen? I have not heard of an affair where some guy meets some random girl and they just go, "Hey, let's get together." It usually doesn't happen that way. The affairs that I have heard about and know about are all between people who know each other. Oftentimes it's in the workplace, or it could be close friends. That's usually how things take place. And let's add one more thing. Does David know Uriah the Hittite? Absolutely. Where do we find that? in 2 Samuel 23, Uriah is listed as one of the 30, as one of David's mighty men. Do you think that somewhere along the way, David met both Uriah and Bathsheba together? This is why I sometimes think that there's probably more to the story that's not being told, and that's okay. I think that Bathsheba and David knew each other, liked each other, probably flirted with each other, because that's how it happens. David is living a distracted life. He is not happy with his current 7 wives. And so he goes and he is looking elsewhere. Sometimes people have asked me, how do I make sure that my husband, that my wife does not have an affair on me? There is a simple answer to that. The best way to prevent an affair is make your marriage the best it can be. I have never run into an affair situation where they said, you know what? Our marriage was fantastic and this just accidentally happened. Usually doesn't happen that way. I guess theoretically it could. But from what I've been able to see in all the counseling I've done, if your marriage is rock solid and there is no distraction in the marriage, you are near guaranteed a safe and secure marriage. Now, that's always hard because that's how it happens. Affairs take place because husbands and wives are fighting and there isn't a desire, there isn't a drive to stick together. But that's the way to do it. First and foremost, focus on getting your marriage to be the most rock solid it could be. And if you are in a situation where your marriage is not in a good place, you need to go to counseling. Plain, period, and simple. You can't get away from it. You've got to go. Waiting is stupid. You go and get it done now. You break your arm, you don't sit there and go, I'll just wait for it to heal. You go to a professional and get it healed. You get it fixed. That's what you need to do with this. People who have strong marriages do not have affairs. So I think David and Bathsheba, David distracted, upset, not doing good. He's not in the war. He's waking up in the middle of the night. He's walking around on his roof. He is living a distracted life. He sees something. I fully believe that he and Bathsheba have met before. There was that spark. It was probably innocent. It was probably just a little bit of flirting, a little bit of smiling. And then the next thing you know, David says, I want her. And so David sent messengers, verse 4, to get her. At that point again, Mr. Messenger, this cannot end well. Someone needs to stand up and say, David, I don't think this is a good idea. You know what? Most of the times, if you disobey the king, the punishment is death. But isn't that better than doing this? Because I'm going to say it, and my deepest apologies if I offend you. I believe Bathsheba is culpable in this whole matter. Because he sends for her, and she could have, if she wanted, said no. Now, if you say no, you're probably going to die. Joseph did it. Do you remember that story? Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Now, you want to talk about temptation. She was already half unclothed at that point when she's making her advances. And he, Joseph, realizes, if I say no, it's not going to end well for me. And sure enough, it didn't. 3 years in prison, this guy sits. But isn't that better? Isn't that something that would be a much... And the nice part now is I don't know of anyone that could happen to now. I guess theoretically, you're working and your boss makes a pass at you and pretty much says, sleep with me or you're fired. You know what? Being fired ain't the worst thing.
Because you could sue him then and make lots of money and then flaunt it in his face. Yeah. Yeah. So I think Bathsheba, now again, I don't know if women took baths in the middle of the night and she's on the roof. Maybe she was in the middle of the night so that there wasn't anyone watching. But Bathsheba could have said no. The last time I checked, affairs, 99% of that time happened between two very willing participants. And there were so many opportunities to just stop it and say no. Like I said, every time I've talked to people who've had affairs, I say, what were some of the warning signs? And they would start listing them out. And I said, how many times did God give you an out? Remember, that's it's one of the most misused Bible passages where it says God can't give you more than you can handle. And we usually take that to mean like pain and suffering stuff. That's not what it says. God will never allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear. And if he does, he'll give you a way out of it. So I always like to ask, after you've been tempted, how many outs did you have? And they always say the same thing. I had hundreds of outs. I could have stopped here. I could have stopped here. I could have seen this. I could have seen that. But I kept going. I kept going. And I kept going. And you cross a little line. And then another little line. And then another little line. And then everyone that I've talked to didn't say, you know what, I woke up one morning and decided, I think today is the day I'm going to ruin my life. Today is the day I'm going to ruin my marriage and everything around me is going to fall apart like a house of cards. It was little by little by little by little. And so in comes Bathsheba, who is also culpable, I believe, in this. She could have said no. She probably would have died. But who cares? I say that so flippantly, don't I, sir? But it says very plainly, she came to him, and he slept with her. And then as a little parenthesis, she had purified herself from her uncleanness. What does that mean? Well, every month, girls experience something where they are in need of lots of chocolate and hugs. I'm just telling you my experience here. And during that time, the Bible is very specific. You are not allowed to sleep with a woman who is on her period. Period. Plain, period, and simple. And then after that's over, I got Leviticus up here, don't I, Dave? I should. I should have Leviticus 15, 28 through 30. When she is cleansed from her discharge, isn't that nice? I like the way that's. She must count off 7 days, and after that she will be ceremonially clean. On the 8th day, she must take 2 doves or 2 young pigeons and bring them to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Is that all I got? The priest is to sacrifice one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. In this way, he will make atonement. I think it's because she's just really mean during that time. And so you got to atone for a sin. For her, I'm just kidding. For her before the Lord for the uncleanness of her discharge. Why? Well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Now, why is this put into the Bible? To prove that this is not Uriah's baby. Because she had just finished getting off her period, and then after that final day, then she had to count off 7 days, then she had to go to the priest, and on the 8th day, she was cleansed. So she is now ripe and ready for something else to happen. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David. We don't hear much from Bathsheba. The only thing we get from Bathsheba are those 3 dreaded words. I am pregnant. Yeah. So, no need to call up Maury Povich. You are the father, David. You're the winner. You did. Now, this is one of those things, again, I've had so many interesting experiences with adultery. I'll tell you one. Way back, no one in here, all right? Way back, I had a gentleman come in to my office. It was a previous church. And he said, I need your help. I need to find out a way to divorce my wife so I can shack up with my lover. And I said, why don't we do this? You pray your way, and I'll pray my way, and we'll see what God does in this whole thing. A week later, the guy came back and said, I'm a schmo, aren't I? And I go, absolutely. And he decided at that point, with much arm twisting by me, to come clean. And he did. Talk about an uncomfortable meeting. I cleared all the desk of all sharp objects. Instructed him that when she says, get out of my sight, you will literally get out of her sight so that I can help her and talk with her through this time. I am pleased to tell you that I actually found out through some weird way that this couple is in fact still very much together, very much still a part of a worshiping community, very much forgiven and loved each other through this whole thing. But that was an opportunity. At this point, David could, if he wanted to, just come clean and just say, that's it, that's the problem. Well, he doesn't. David cooks up a brand new plan. So David sent this word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. Now, I mean, it's kind of funny when you think about it, really. There you are, you're Uriah, you're one of the 30 men, you're one of David's personal bodyguard type of people, and you're out fighting a war, and all of a sudden you get the little telegram, David wants to see you now. So what do? You pack up, and you make a 50-mile trek back to Jerusalem so that you can meet with David. And at this point, I don't know if Uriah just hasn't figured stuff out, because what would you expect the king to say to you after pulling you off of the front line of the battle so that you could come and meet with him? I love this. This is hilarious. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Wouldn't that be great? Like, he's just trekked in. He comes in. David, yeah, all right. Yes, sir, my king, what do you need? How's it going? How's the war going? Good, sir. How's Joab? Fine. Great. Things going well. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of these comical things that you're like, if I were Uriah, I'd be like, are you serious? You pulled me off the front lines of battle so that I could come here and have a little small talk with you? It doesn't even record, Uriah's answer. I don't think David was listening in the first place. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Which was code, that would be like, why don't you go home, take a load off. You're probably tired. Been away from your wifey poo. What do you think David's wanting at this point? Uriah, why don't you go and hang out with your wifey? You know, it's all good. Hoping to maybe hide the sin, because if Uriah ends up sleeping with his wife and then has a baby, we're only off by a day or two from that 9-month period. No one's going to suspect. Uriah's going to be the happiest guy in the world because Bathsheba's conceived and now they have a kid. So Uriah left his palace and a gift from the king was sent after him. I mean, and the word is, the connotation is that it was food. So he sent some royal food. Why don't you go have a nice little dinner on me? Go hang out on your rooftop for a little while. Have Bathsheba bathe a little bit. You'll be all good. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. Which probably tells you why Bathsheba was one of those willing participants. Right? Her husband comes home from the war. And where does he go and sleep? He sleeps with the servants. I can't say that. Uriah is a very righteous man. And I don't know if that was the whole reason why. But then David was told Uriah did not go home. He asked him, haven't you come from a great distance? Why didn't you go home? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents. And my master Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. That's pretty amazing. By the way, this is all coming from a non-Jew. He's a Hittite. Remember, he's one of those ites, the Jebusites, Adicites, Cellulites, and Hittites. That was one of the crew. Uriah is an outsider. Now, he becomes a Jew because he says Uriah is now his new name, and Uriah means the Lord is my light. So Uriah is a pretty upstanding kind of guy. Verse 12, then David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I'll send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, David's got a new plan. He ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. Fantastic. Because we all know what guys do when they're drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. And then as one pastor points out, Uriah is more righteous drunk than David is when he's sober, which is a pretty sad statement. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, and this is just, you're reaching new lows here, my friend. Who does he send the note with? I mean, Uriah is so right. Now, if you don't know what the note says, you'll find out in just a moment. It's essentially Uriah's death letter. It's essentially David's going to ask Joab to get Uriah killed. And it's so crazy that he hands it to Uriah. And he knows, I mean, would you have been tempted? Like, hey, here I am. It's a 50-mile trek on back down to the lines. And I'm carrying this letter from the king for Joab. Wouldn't you just like want to take a little peeky-poo? Check out what's in there? I think I would. Uriah, because what would you do if all of a sudden you read this? And look at what it says. It might have a seal. I do admit it might have a seal, and if you break the seal. But I would have been like, dude, I dropped it, and it landed on a rock. Well, wait a second. Then Uriah would be a liar, and that's how we got into this whole mess in the first place. And in it he wrote, put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw for him so he will be struck down and die. And you want to wonder at that point. Again, Joab's going to get this message. Could Joab have said, you know what, king? This is a bad idea. But he doesn't. So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. I don't know how many commandments he's now broken. It's a lot. It's five. Yeah, it's he's breaking a lot of commandments here. Now he's added death, killing someone to this count. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, when you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone in him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why'd you get... That's a Old Testament story where a poor guy gets a millstone, an upper millstone. That's one of those, you know, big giant concrete donuts, and some chick took it to the wall, and the guy was there, and she flung it over, and it smashed him. And then he's sitting there going, someone please come over here and kill me. They're like, why? He goes, I don't want to say that a chick killed me by dropping a millstone on me. That's totally embarrassing. And so Joab is reminding him, hey, remember, sometimes there are casualties. I know we're besieging this town, and we're supposed to keep our distance. We're cutting off all the supplies to take it over. Why did I get so close? Sometimes it happens. And anyway, why did you get so close to the wall? If he asks you this, then say to him, the code word, also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. Because you can imagine, he's going to get this report, and if he doesn't remember all this stuff, he's going to get angry for Joab for pulling such a stunt, getting too close to the wall. And he just says, and by the way, just let him know that Uriah the Hittite is dead. The messenger set out, and he arrived and told David everything Joab had said to him. The messenger said to David, the men overpowered us and came out against us in the open. We drove them back to the entrance of the city gate. Then the archers shot arrows at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's men died. Moreover, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. I kind of like, because the messenger ain't going to wait for the king's anger to flare up. He's like, oh, by the way, a bunch of people are dead. We got a little close. Oh, wait. Uriah the Hittite is dead. David told the messenger,
say this to Joab. Don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as another. Press the attack against the city and destroy it. Say this to encourage Joab. Now that's an interesting reaction. I mean, we kind of get this idea that at this point David is really trying to cover his backside, so he's becoming very calculating, very callous. He hears that one of his 30 is dead. And I wonder if at this point the messenger doesn't, like, why do I need to let him know that Uriah the Hittite is dead? And then when he tells him the news, David has a very different reaction than he normally does when someone dies. Because there's two other times, you ready, David? Two other times that someone dies. Saul dies. And what do? They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. Remember, a bunch of people were all excited and he was like, this is not a day of celebration. Saul has died. And they wept. Same thing happened, remember, a little bit later, Abner, commander of the northern army that was trying to do the coup, and Abner dies. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. All the people wept also. So David is supposed to be weeping at this point, but he doesn't even care. And this is what happens. You tell a lie to yourself enough, eventually becomes truth. It's a proven physiological phenomenon. You are told something over and over and over until you finally say, I believe it. And that's what happens in situations like this. People do stuff and they just keep saying it. It's not that bad. It's not a problem. I haven't done anything wrong. Everything is fine. And when you find yourself doing that, it is mind-numbing, which is why you need at that point someone around you to say, this is wrong. Just so you know, keep that in verse 25. Say this to Joab. Don't let this upset you. Upset is probably, it's a little bit stronger than like, hey, don't let this bother you type thing. The word is raw. And in this thing, it's just like the step down from what raw usually means, which is true and utter anger. So it's a step lower than don't let this anger you. Don't let this be some sort of evil in your sight. That's kind of the connotation that's going here. But it does, yes, there's this idea of bothering. This same phrase is going to show up last couple words of this chapter. Verse 26. When Uriah's wife, wow, can't even say her name, can we? When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord, the same exact phrase as before. And it is true. I don't care how secretive you are. I don't care how much you try to hide it. It is a proven fact that any sin you commit, even if no one else is watching, someone is. And they've done the studies on this. They've actually asked men and women, if you could have an affair and no one know about, I mean, it would be rock solid, no one would find out. The percentages are over 50%. People would say, yeah, I'd do that. During communion, we're going to sing a song, and it has some really, really good lyrics in the third verse, where the person writing this says that he is prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. And so we actually ask God, take my heart and fetter it, tie it to you. Seal it in thy courts above.
That is a prayer that is fantastic, because I could probably poll you right now and say, who here is planning on having an affair? And I don't think any of you would raise your hand. Now, if you would have raised your hand in your mind, you need to come see me immediately. Now, that is something that needs to be talked about. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be fixed. But that's not how it starts usually. It doesn't start with you in that state. It starts first and foremost with a distraction, a problem in the marriage, a difficulty, a conflict you can't solve. The conversation level drops. You don't have that same relationship. And all of a sudden, that's when that distraction normally leads to an attraction. And the best thing to do is stop it now. But if you are in that attraction phase, if you're thinking to yourself, I am attracted to someone else. And I had this at another previous congregation. I had a man come in my office and he said, I need some help. I know that I am about to take a step that I should not take. And I'm like, praise God you came to me first. And I said, you do know what I'm going to tell you, right? And he goes, I do, and I need to hear it. And he told me all about the story, how he and his wife had problems, and those problems had festered for years and years and years. And not being able to be solved, he starts turning his gaze outward. And he starts looking at a female that is at his work. And instead of just looking at her and talking to her, all of a sudden that attraction starts building. And he's sending her flowers and chocolates and gifts. And he knows that he is right at the precipice, about ready to move into the next step. There is only one thing to do at that point. Drastic measures to remove yourself from the temptation. If you're dieting, don't keep Twinkies in your house. I always told you the story, like I tried to stop eating Whoppers for a while. On the way to church, there's a couple Burger Kings, so I just had to change my route. But I always said, oh, I got such strong temptation. I finally had to look at the guy and I said, quit your job. And he goes, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? Yes, you can. Quit your job. I said, what do you do for a living? He says, I'm a welder. Are you working at the only company that has welders? He goes, no, there's lots of them. I said, fantastic. You're going to go in and give your 2-week notice. Then you're going to find a new job. And then you're going to get some counseling. And he did it. He quit. I was a woman secretary in the welder. So yeah. Yeah. Now that's it. Now let me tell you something. I'll tell you something really interesting about affairs. This is the other thing that's very fascinating. In almost every single one of the cases of affairs that I had, the person that the guy slept with was uglier than his wife. It happens. Because for guys, it's not just about the looks. At that point, there were such problems in the relationship that the man was not receiving any respect in the household. And then he would go to work, and he'd have all these people respecting him and honoring him. And I know the flip side happens. I know that a woman can go into a work situation and be honored and respected and have authority and feel real good and have men that are swooning after her. And then she goes home, and there's that slobby man sitting on the couch, drinking a beer and watching the football game. And she goes, why do I have this when I could have this? And that's how it happened. So David is an interesting person, because Bathsheba was very pleasant to look at. But that wasn't normally happens. And then the question has to be asked, is adultery the unforgivable sin? And the answer is no. Because that it's about, I've got about a 50-50% success rate counseling couples that have had affairs where they've actually made it. And the girls always tell me the same thing. They say, you know what? I had always said that if my man cheats on me, I'm dropping him like a hot rock. And you can imagine if you had a friend who got cheated on, your counsel to them might simply be, dump the dude, move on, let's get going. And she said, I can't. I just can't turn that love off like a faucet. So you'll be surprised if that situation hits you. But all I'm telling you is that it's messy, it's nasty, it is not worth it. There is no situation when I can imagine that it's worth it to mess up your marriage for something else. You all know that 50% of marriages end in divorce. If you try with number two, you're up to 75% failure rate. Congratulations to anyone who has married a second time and still together, because you're beating the odds. Hopefully you learned from a previous relationship. But I'm telling you now, the grass is not greener. It is dangerous. It is poison. You don't want any part of it. And all I can ask you and beg from you is, if you're there, please talk to me, talk to someone else, talk to anyone. Get it out in the open so that you can deal with it. And now I am withholding because we're not getting into chapter 12, because that's when we finally see something else. But I'm going to tell you right from the get-go, what this did displeased God. In fact, there's one other passage on my PowerPoint, 1 Kings chapter 15. For David had done what was right in the eyes of the Lord and had not failed to keep any of the Lord's command all the days of his life. Oh, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. That's how much this displeased God. And I'll tell you why I think it displeased God the most. Because like I said later on, there's going to be a body count that's much higher than Uriah and some fighting people that die in a battle. And then the kid also dies. Oh, and if you didn't know, this kid dies also. The thing that I think upset God the most was it took a while for this sin to get talked about. And I know how it is. I'm sure at this point, David is thinking to himself, I've already gone too far. I've already messed up so much. Just waiting a little bit longer. If I say it now, it's going to be embarrassing. All I can tell you is this. The longer you wait, the more damage it takes. Coming clean immediately now is what is necessary. And I think the reason why this displeased God the most was because it took over 9 months for David to finally say, oops, I made a mistake. Starts with a distraction, turns into an attraction, and ends in an action. Let's pray. Lord God, I pray for everyone here. I pray especially for marriages. And yet if we're not married, I pray that this teaches us something. That maybe someone's not going to die, but there's going to be damage and it's going to be hard. And I pray, Lord, that you would seal our hearts. And that if we have an issue or a problem right now, that we would have the guts and the courage that you would embolden us right now, that we would make a decision right now. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get stuff out in the open and come clean so that I can get things moving again in my life. No matter what the pain, no matter what the consequences, no matter what the heartache. And I pray that you would help us to accomplish that. I thank you, Lord, that in a spiritual way, you are so faithful to us. For we have hitched our wagons on other stars. We have bowed down to other idols. We have been unfaithful to you in so many ways. And yet you are so faithful to us and that you love us. Even though we, like a prostitute, continually go away, you always come to us with gentle love. Give us strength to come clean. Give us love in our hearts for forgiveness. Most importantly, may we keep the marriage bed sacred and pure so that it would be holy in your sight and in your eyes. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.